Now we're recording. So usually I start these things by saying that this is the 20th of August, 2012. My name is Mike Grayson. I am in Münster, Germany, interviewing Professor Franz Hillenkamp. And I believe that's all of the important stuff that has to be in the front. So whoever picks this up knows what it's about. It's not like has to figure out what's going on. Who are these two people and why are they talking about these things? So typically what we like to do is find out how you got to where you are in your career. And a lot of that depends on your parents and their education and their parents' education and a little bit of background. So could you describe something about your parents and then your forebears before that?
Yeah. Okay. So I was born on March 18, 1936, in Essen, which is rather relatively close by here. It's actually the center of the industry of coal and steel industry in Germany, which is important for what comes now. Mm-hmm. My father was a judge, and his father was a judge, and his grandfather was a judge. And all male members of his family were in law somehow.
Interesting.
So that might have been one option for me, but I choose not to go to law. My mother had an education in what you might call home economics, but she was never professionally active. As was typical for a bourgeois family, you know, the wife would not work, but she would take care of the children. Both parents are from this area of Germany, Westphalia, actually. However, the family of my wife, of my mother, originally came from England. Her maiden name is Russell.
R-U-S-S?
Yeah, right.
E-L-L. Interesting.
Yeah. So, I have three sisters, one older and two younger sisters. And they were all born also in Essen. However, when I was 4 years of age in 1940, World War II started. And there was the expectation that pretty soon Essen would get bombed by the Allies. And a colleague of my father had a small vacation house in a very small village in the Austrian mountains. And he offered my father that he could use that for his wife and the children. Everyone expected that the whole war would be over within half a year or so, which of course didn't happen. So the most important years of my growing up were actually in this remote small village. And I went to school there, in elementary school, 4 years. And this was a one classroom school with one teacher, which in a way gave me the opportunity to learn whatever was taught within the first 2 years or 3 years. But I must say, this teacher was the best I've ever had. He was extremely good. For example, he taught us the law of conservation of energy. Now, he didn't call it that way, but he taught it in a way that was of interest to the farmers there. That is, he had this set of pulleys, and his statement was, what you gain in force, you lose in distance. And then he was pulling the string and showed that the more pulleys there were, the longer stretch you had to pull for the same lifting up of a weight or so.
This is in grade school.
Yeah, this was in grade school. Yeah.
What was his name?
Oh, what was his name? Hack, H-A-G-G. But no one would use last names in that village. He was called, you know, the teacher is ein Lehrer in German.
Yeah.
And he was called in the dialect, the Lehrer. But Hag was his last name.
He was just the teacher.
He was just the teacher, right.
Everybody knew that, and that was it. They didn't even know anymore.
Yeah.
So he's teaching you conservation of energy in grade school. So how many people were in this small one-room school?
Well, in my grade, do you say grade
Yeah,
in my grade, we were three. Uh-huh. And in some other grades, there were a few more. But as far as I remember, there was a total of 25.
Maybe. Altogether.
Altogether, right.
Let's see, there was a point I wanted to ask about, but it escaped my mind, so let's go on. So you said you spent 4 years at this one room. Oh, yes. Would it be not more normal for a woman to teach in these schools? Or, like in America, generally...
In grammar school, it would be women.
Yeah.
It is still so in Germany, and I think it was that way in Austria as well. But I didn't know, I mean, this was the only teacher I knew about. You know, in this village, there wasn't a single car.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't a single tractor.
What was the name of the village?
The village is Duns. D-U-E-N-S. Actually, it's U-Umlaut,
Oh, okay, sure.
If you have.
Yeah, I'll put a note there.
And it's in the state of Vorarlberg.
F-O-R.
No, V. V.
Da, v. v. Or
Arlberg, A-R-L-B-E-R-G, for Arlberg.
A-V-O-R-A-R-L-D.
For no, no D. A B. A B. Yeah.
B.
Berg.
B-R. Ah,
Berg.
Okay.
Berg. For Arlberg.
Yeah.
And this is actually very close to Lake Constance and the Swiss border.
Mm-hmm.
So we could look into Switzerland, though during the war, of course, we couldn't go there.
Mm-hmm. Did the war affect this area? I guess that's why you went there, is it didn't really affect, you weren't as affected in that area.
Right. The way I grew up, we children didn't hardly knew about the war. The only thing that was different from what might otherwise have been was that my father just came for Christmas and during summer vacation,
mm-hmm.
because as a judge he had to stay back in Essen, of course, where mm-hmm. his office was and his court. It was a real small village, as I said. No car, no tractor, one horse for the whole village. Yeah. And a few oxen to pull cars when there was need.
There's an expression in America for a small town as a one-horse town.
This absolutely was a one-horse town. The area there is very Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and both my parents were Catholic, so I served as an altar boy,
mm-hmm.
and generally, life was simple, but very good for children.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happened, children could understand. It was quite a bit dominated by Christian holidays.
Mm-hmm.
We went on these long pilgrimages, like 8 hours or so,
mm-hmm.
over the mountains to some other place, and then back at night. But anyway, for small children, I think this is the ideal
mm-hmm.
way to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we were fully immersed in that life, we understood things, which gives you self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like in a bigger town where there are many things going on that children don't understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very fortunate, I must say, to be given that chance. But it lasted until 1947,
mm-hmm.
and the area was occupied by the French army,
mm-hmm.
and they insisted that we go back to Germany,
mm-hmm.
because we were Germans and not Austrians, and of course Austria separated from Germany at that time.
Was there a language problem in Austria versus Germany, because they have slightly different...
Yes and no. Of course, German is the language in all of Austria, mm-hmm. but in this village they spoke a dialect which is almost a different language. Actually, you may know that in Switzerland you have four languages. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You have German, French, Italian, and a fourth one which most people don't know about, which is called Romanic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this dialect in this village was sort of a mixture of German and Romanian. Romanskladin is the right word for that.
Mm-hmm.
We children would speak, of course, the dialect to with the other children and to all of the adults in the village. But with my mother, we spoke High German.
Mm.
And my mother learned to understand the dialect, but she never spoke it.
Mm. Yes. So High German has its own grammar, primarily, right?
But here it's more vocabulary. The vocabulary is very different, and actually the teacher, the Lehrer, would teach in dialect.
Mm-hmm.
And when he wanted to teach us some High German, he would refer to my sister and me how that is. Yeah. And sometimes we had to laugh because he would literally translate it. It sounded very strange for us. Yeah. In order, to have enough food and to survive, we ran sort of a small farm enterprise.
Oh, okay.
We had some fields and planted vegetable and potatoes and mm-hmm. what have you, and got, of course, some from the village people.
So did you work in the fields then?
Yes. I learned how to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was good that my mother had some background in it,
mm-hmm.
so she
yes.
would help. And actually, early after we arrived there, two other cousins came of my sister and myself. So we were all together, six children and my mother. And so that was my early childhood, so to speak. And if you ask me where I really feel at home,
mm-hmm.
it's still there. It's in the mountains. And it has had a strong influence on my later life. I did rock climbing and a lot of mountaineering and skiing.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in winter, we couldn't go to school without skis.
Oh.
Yeah, there was much more snow for that.
So I was at altitude?
Not very high, around 800 meters, I think. But enough snow, at least for some time. Again, back in 1947,
mm-hmm.
we had to go back to Germany. Now, Essen was almost completely destroyed, and there was no room, no houses, no apartments to be had. But my grandparents, my mother's parents, had a summer house just north of this industrial area, south of Münster here, not very far from here, actually. And my grandfather had died by then, but my grandmother lived there.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved in with her.
So the war had, by 1947, the war was kaput, finished.
Oh, the war finished in 45.
Yeah, 45.
And it had certainly finished by then, but even in 1955, when I went to Munich, mm-hmm. Munich was half destroyed. Half of the buildings or so were in rubbles.
Mm-hmm.
So, the school that I went to had been bombed. So it was still, you could certainly still see the signs of war, and for a couple of years until about 1950, food was very scarce.
Mm-hmm.
So we were hungry quite a number of times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the French were essentially, this would have been after the war, their partition.
Right.
Of Austria
was separate,
mm-hmm.
and that soon became independent again. Where Germany stayed occupied to various degrees until about 1955 or so, mm-hmm. And this area here was occupied by the British Army,
okay.
and The French had the southwestern part that was bordering France.
Okay, because I think Vienna was also partitioned.
Oh, but Vienna and Berlin were both partitioned among the four allies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, but
because that's where the third man. The movie about the third man.
Yeah, yeah, in Vienna, yeah, yeah, third man, with the very famous Harry Lime melody.
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
We were there, and. Apparently, there's a picture of the show house, the movie house,
yeah.
That shows this movie every Friday night at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think so.
Every, you know, so it's yeah. Really kind of fun to go there.
It's almost as famous as Casablanca.
And the fact that, you know, we had been traveling in Vienna, then you could see in the movies the same places that you had traveled, but ravaged by war. It's really, really very striking.
Yeah,
so you're back in this part of the country then,
In 47 we came here, and...
So your education is still, you're in grade school
still? Well, I went to grade school for a few months or so, but didn't do very well. One of the reasons was that I wasn't used to speak High German in school.
Ah.
You know, and during breaks, I would stand together with my sister, and we would speak the Austrian dialect. And then the other pupils didn't like that.
Yeah.
So we had a pretty hard time.
Yeah.
Then in 48 or so, the high school, which is called Gymnasium in the nearby town of Lünen,
let me get Gymnasium in here.
Gymnasium, yeah.
What's this, how, L-U?
G-Y.
G-Y.
G.
Okay.
They just add an M here.
Okay.
Gymnasium.
Yeah.
Yeah. M. Gymnasium.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, so that's high school.
Huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I well remember... when I got there, I jumped the first grade in the gymnasium because I had been taught some Latin by a retired priest, you know, back in Austria, and my parents thought that I should keep going with my education. But the first day we went there, we were shown the classroom. The classroom, there was no glass in the windows, there was no desk, no... chairs, we had to sit on the floor. We had no books, we had almost no paper to write on. It was a very strange situation. I think it didn't have much effect on the long run, but for a while the school life was somewhat different from what you would otherwise expect.
Now, your father stayed in
Essen. Essen.
So did he have any, experienced some difficulties with the war, because he was in Essen during the whole war period, right?
Right.
So was he ever, did he ever talk about being feeling threatened by...
Yes, actually, very much so. My father was brought up very Catholic, actually, and my mother's family was not Nazi, but right-wing. You know, there was some other more conservative parties originally. My father was the only one in the larger family who was not on this political ticket, let's say. And after the war, actually until he retired, he suffered from the fact that he thought he should have done more against the Nazi regime, but you know, with a family of four small children, what can you do?
Well, it was difficult because people who expressed themselves too strongly were stepped on.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
So
yeah. And also the judges in Germany are public servants, they are not elected, and they are what we call the third power in the state, and they are not supposed to be very active politically. We tried to convince him that he did what he could have done, but that didn't help that much. There was also the other problem. Judges cannot be moved around from one town to another. They the town they start out, they will stay with.
So
he stayed in Essence for lifelong.
Oh, wow.
And he only came for the weekends. Mm-hmm. So essentially, I grew up without a father.
Yeah.
I cannot recall that I suffered from that, or that I thought, you know, something was missing. Mm-hmm. So my mother was a very strong personality. Mm-hmm. She made up for it, let's say.
But it's interesting that she would have English roots, right?
Yeah.
But she had more sympathy, apparently, with the right wing in Germany than your dad did, it sounds like.
That's right. But you see, the connection to England was long ago. The last person, or the first predecessor that we know of mm-hmm. in her family, was a British officer who came to Germany, to an area north of Munster here, when the whole House of Hanover took over the throne in England.
Okay.
So that was quite some time ago.
Okay. So and she was basically, she had English roots, but basically...
Yeah, but by that time, it was a German family.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
So you're still finishing off grade school, basically. Now you're in gymnasium.
But now I'm at the gymnasium.
And
the gymnasium is, the whole schooling was 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So 9 years of gymnasium.
Mm-hmm.
And there was sort of an intermediate exam after the 6th year in gymnasium.
Okay.
And just a special name, which is not important here. But at that point, I was given the choice whether I wanted to specialize on math and sciences or the liberal arts.
Okay.
And I choose the, and we were the first year that this was allowed.
Okay.
Normally, the gymnasium was strictly liberal arts with Latin and Greek as foreign languages and so on. I never had to take Greek, actually I took English and Latin. And I choose the mathematical scientific branch. To be honest, I don't know exactly why. When I think about it, I had relatively good grades in physics and in mathematics. We had a very good teacher in those two topics, which is important, and our teacher is in German and English. We're not very good. There was another reason. My grandmother, you know, who we were living with in her house.
This is your mother's side.
My mother's side grandmother, mm-hmm. right. She was always well-to-do. My grandfather was the director of a coal mine, and she never had to work. So she spent all her time educating herself.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, she would know almost the whole Faust by Goethe, by heart, you know. And I had considered that I got much more education in the liberal arts from my grandmother than from the school, but nothing about math and sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I had a good teacher. That's, I think, something that's very important.
Now, this division, does that go on in today's gymnasium, where they still do that? Or?
The German gymnasium has gone through dozens of reforms.
Oh, okay.
And just last week, my oldest granddaughter started gymnasium in Kiel, in the town in northern Germany, and she decided, or her parents decided, to send her to a classical gymnasium. So she will start with Latin, and her school is actually called the School of the Scientists.
School of?
Of the Scientists.
School of the Scientists. The
Lehrtenschule. It exists since 1200 something, so very, very long tradition. But there are other schools which start with English or with French. So since then, a lot of things have happened.
And the gymnasium is administered or driven or formed by the federal government, by the
no, government? No. All what we call cultural activities mm-hmm. are state activities, and the states are very jealous of the federal government that the federal government might interfere with their decision making, mm-hmm. which has as a consequence that teachers, for example, have a hard time to move from one state to another. And if, let's say, when I was moving to Munster, mm-hmm. and if my wife would have been a teacher, mm-hmm. it would have been difficult for her to get a job here. Wow. And also for children, when parents move, it's not so easy. Hmm. So this is strictly state affair.
So Westphalia would be the state that controls?
North Rhine-Westphalia.
Ah, okay.
So the most southern point is about Cologne.
Uh-huh.
Huh? Mm-hmm. And the most northern part is Osnabrück, which is north of Münster, not very far.
Mm, okay. Mm-hmm.
So
that entity is able to divide or control its own educational system.
Right. Oh, right.
Okay.
Right. So, except for very few private schools, schools are run by the public service.
Ah, okay.
And teachers are public servants.
Ah.
Yeah. Almost all of them.
Do you have any sense of that? Whether they're well paid? Most of the teachers in America, I think, don't.
First of all, in the first number of years in gymnasium, mm-hmm. the question was not how much you get paid, but how to get food.
Yeah.
That was a much more difficult task. And no, I think teachers are reasonably well paid, mm-hmm. I must mm-hmm. say. If you ask a teacher, he may look at that.
Yeah, right.
Point, but no, I think it is a respected profession.
That's
put this way. That's certainly. Yeah. So.
So then, when you moved here, you just mentioned food again. So, how did? What were the exact kind of problems you had getting food when you came back to this part of the country? Was it just that there was nothing, or?
It was. For example. There was a huge garden with the house of my grandmother,
yeah.
and most of it was used to be flower gardens. So that was all converted into vegetable mm-hmm. and potato garden, mm-hmm. and we had chicken and we had rabbits and
some pepper, huh?
Yeah, right. And for example, when the farmers would harvest their potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
After they had cleared the field, we would go and look for what was left and collected potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Mm-hmm. The same is true for corn.
Mm-hmm.
So get enough food was a concern originally.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, let's say from 1950 on or so, things normalized and you could buy whatever food was needed.
What about meat? I guess chicken, like you say, chicken and rabbit was it meat? You served for protein for you wouldn't have flesh with the cow or pork.
Because of the special kitchen, we would say in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
We had meat only once a week, so mm-hmm. only on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, sometimes not. We would have different dishes,
mm-hmm.
which are very tasty and are good enough to grow up on. You know? So, so the meat wasn't that much of a problem, I would say.
Okay.
It was more staple food,
mm-hmm.
you know, the potatoes in particular. Not that much pasta then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I grew up in a family which where education was considered very important,
mm-hmm.
Both by my parents mm-hmm. and by my grandmother. Actually, my grandmother was sort of the role model for us. Still from that time, I like poems, you know, and learned many of them by heart at that time.
That's interesting.
Yeah, right. So, in school, I was never a straight A student or so. Maybe I could have, but I didn't care, and I had too many other interests, let's say. In between, once in the third year of the gymnasium, my parents got a letter at Christmas time that there was no chance for me to make it to the next grade because my grades, you know, were all C's and F's. And my mother was, of course, really concerned. She went to see my math teacher, and he told her, you know what, I have been observing Franz, and I think he's going to make it. There is some switch that hasn't been powered yet, but he will make it. Actually, by Easter, that's when the school year ended, by Easter, I had not a single grade less than a B.
Oh, my.
I mean, it was strange. But other than that...
But, I mean, did you get negative feedback or positive feedback from your parents about your grade situation that motivated you, or did you...
I know. I think it wasn't a question of feedback. It was one special, actually, way in mathematics. I don't know how to say that in English. In German, it's called Dreisatz. It is like if 10 people need 4 pounds of meat, how much meat will 70 people need?
Word problems.
And you know, more difficult. And all of a sudden, I understood what this was all about, and I couldn't remember why I had so much difficulties. And this gave me self-confidence on the other topics as well. I think that's what it was. So I remained a B to A student throughout my school time, but I must admit that... let me first say, I like to go to school. I like to learn. But I like to learn only what I like to learn and not what the teachers wanted me to learn at times, which made it difficult. And the best example of that was that every time we got our certificates, you know, once a year, my teacher in physics and maths would look at my certificate and say, you know, this is ridiculous. You have an A in physics, you have an A in mathematics, and you have a C minus or an F in chemistry.
No.
So I didn't like chemistry when I was in high school. I don't know why. But it has been, I think, a theme throughout my life that I mostly did what I liked to do and didn't want too many people to interfere with my plans. So I graduated from high school in 1955.
Okay.
Then the question was what profession to go into. Now, my father, I know, would have liked me to see me go into law, but I told him that I wasn't interested, and he didn't insist, really, you know, let me do what I wanted. And I decided to take up a curriculum in electrical engineering.
Okay.
For no good reason. I don't know. Sign of that is that about a half year before graduation, we had to write a paper about our future plans. Yeah, and in the paper, of course, I wrote, I wanted to be an engineer. And when our German teacher returned that to us, He looked at me and said, you know, if you want to go into engineering, you should at least know how to spell engineering. It would be as if I would have in English spelled engineer with only one E at the end. You know? So that was... it was just my choice. I also decided to register at the Technical University in Munich. Mm-hmm. The reason there was obvious. I wanted to get back close to the mountains. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, mm-hmm. that was where I felt at home.
So this process of selection schooling after high school, was it, you know, in America now it's very intense and you send out applications yeah. all over the world and all this business. But so, I mean, did you just select the TUM and then go there, or did you be admitted?
TUM, yes, at that time, it was Technische Hochschule.
Ah, okay.
It later became a university. Later. Now it has a medical school or and all that. Yeah. At that time it was strictly engineering school, but at the level of the university. Mm-hmm. And no, they had limited admission, so I had to take an entrance exam. And I thought after I came out of that exam I had flunked it, but apparently others were even worse than I was. So I got admitted.
Was it many people applying more than there were positions, do you know? Or?
I don't know. I would, if I try to recall the lecture hall where we took the exam, maybe twice as many applications as there were positions available. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
But this, you selected the school primarily because...
I selected the school, but, you know, if I would have failed that exam, I might have selected Aachen, for example. Okay. I would have applied there and gone there. But I wanted to go to Munich and I passed the exam, decided that I would go there. Now, during the first four semesters, the first 2 years of engineering curriculum, we mostly... had lectures in mathematics, in physics, in chemistry, in drawing, basic fields, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure, you know, how well I was doing, and I worked pretty hard during those first 2 years. And then after those 2 years, there was what we call the pre-diploma, an exam, all written actually, and you could go on with your studies only if you passed that exam. And they posted a list of all students and how well they did in that exam. And it turned out, to my great surprise, that I was among the top 10%. And that was the good side. The bad side was that the very moment the most specialized lectures and laboratories on electrical engineering started, I found out I wasn't interested at all. I thought that I would be better off if I would switch to physics. I tried to do that, but the system was very rigid. They said I would have to start from scratch again, which, you know, would have cost me 2 years, and I didn't want to do that. So in reality, I finished my curriculum in electrical engineering, but never intended to work in that field, and in fact, I never did. And for my diploma thesis, I picked a topic which was more in physics than in engineering already.
What happened to those students who, at the end of their 2 years in the pre-diploma, did not pass? What happened to them? Did they have any options, or did they start out their career at a lower... level? Or?
Well, both, I think. There was no organized way for them to what to do at that point. Mm. But, you know, we also now have these sort of engineering schools, which are somewhat below the level of university. Mm. And how do they call themselves?
There's a, what they call trade schools.
That's what it would be.
That kind of thing.
And they were not in existence then. So I think those students either took up another curriculum or just dropped out and took up a job, mm-hmm. most probably.
So did your engineering ever come in handy at all? I mean, I know that you didn't pursue it as a, but I mean, in the process of your career, having a knowledge of the electrical engineering, I would assume helped you along the way.
Before I was allowed to enter the university, I had to do hands-on work in a machine company or so for half a year, and during my curriculum, again in an electronic company or so. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot there. For example, I learned how to operate a lathe, mm-hmm. or a milling machine, mm-hmm. or to draw, you know, for pieces, and that has helped me a lot later on when I was designing and constructing my own mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that would be what we call mechanical drawing.
Yeah, right. So you know, it was more the mechanical part of it than the electrical, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is a 2-year, 6 months requirement for all students?
For all engineering students, right.
Okay.
Again, that has changed meanwhile. Now it's only a quarter of a year. But
they still have to kind of get...
Get some hands-on work to get a feel for what it's good for, what they learn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they do that after their degree? Or some of it during their studies?
Some of them before, and some of them during their studies.
Okay.
Okay. Because we have long summer vacation in universities. So,
what is the school year?
Well, a typical school year would start in May and end in July, August, and then start again in October and end in February.
So you have two breaks?
Yeah. Now, again, the school year has been extended somewhat, mm-hmm. but during my time, that was a typical school year.
Okay.
And as I said, I finished the engineering curriculum, and then I had to take the main exams for the diploma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were no master's degrees then.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I had to write a diploma thesis, which would typically have taken a year, 1.5 years.
Mm.
And this, there is a real break in my development at that point, because I had just started my diploma thesis when I got awarded the Fulbright Scholarship. I had applied for the school Fulbright Scholarship, and actually I had learned about the Fulbright program from my aunt. My mother had a much younger sister, 16 years junior, and she was in diplomatic service. And she spent all her time as a cultural attaché at first the German General Consulate in New York, and then at the embassy in Washington. So, you know, she was very familiar with the U.S. and the options, and she told me, why don't you apply for a Fulbright Scholarship?
Mm-hmm.
And I did, and I got it for whatever reason. My English certainly wasn't very good then. But
now, were you taught English in school?
Yeah, I was taught English in high school.
High school.
But, you know, we learned more Elizabethan English.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember, is this a dagger which I see in front of before me? The hand towards my hand? Come and let me touch thee. That's Hamlet.
Yeah, it's real good English.
Yeah, so I learned my colloquial English when I was in the U.S. So, and, you know, I was told that I would get the scholarship maybe in July or so. And, you know, the American school year started in October.
Yeah.
So there was not much time, certainly not enough time to finish my thesis. And I absolutely wanted to go to the United States. At that time, this was, looking from Europe, it was sort of a paradise. That was in 57. No, sorry. This was in 60.
1960.
So I went to see the chairman of the examination committee, mm-hmm. who was a high-frequency engineer and was the star of the faculty at that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I asked him whether he would grant me a year of leave so I could spend that year in the United States. And he said no. He said, you know, you should finish your thesis, and after you've finished your thesis, I can always help you to get a job somewhere. There's a company in the mm-hmm. U.S. Mm-hmm. A year at an American university is a waste of time. I'm not granting you the year of leave. So, first of all, I was...
So why did... you said the American university would be a waste of time. I mean, was that because he had a bias against American education? Or
I have no idea. I think it was more bureaucratic, that he wanted people to stay on track.
Okay. Yeah.
That was more, you know, he thought that I was within a year to finish my diploma, mm-hmm. and then I would have an exam that was similar to the master's degree in the U.S., mm-hmm. so why spend another year?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he thought that I would goof off the year anyway.
No.
Well, he said no. So I was devastated.
Yeah.
I was really devastated.
Yeah.
So I think you, at some point you asked about mentors or so.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see what we call my diploma father. He was my mentor for the diploma thesis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Actually, Knoll was his name. He was...
How do you spell that?
Knoll, K-N-O-L-L.
K-N-O-L-L, okay.
Yeah. He did some very important early work in electron microscopy.
Okay.
Actually. And so I went to see him and said, you know, what can I do? I really want to go to the United States, and the other professor doesn't grant me a year leave. And then he said, well, that's really bad, and he's a very powerful man, so what can we do? And then he looked at me and he said, you know, I really don't have to look after you every day.
Go away, kid.
That was exactly what he said. He said, make sure that for the second semester in that year, you fill out the registration forms already and have your friends turn them in for you.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, if Meinke was the other professor's name, if he finds out that you have gone, then I can't help you.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the rules are against you.
Yeah, yeah.
But...
if he doesn't know you're
right. But I won't tell him, you know.
Okay.
I won't be looking for you all every day.
How do you spell the big bad guy's name, Meinke?
Meinke, yeah. M-E-I-N-K-E.
Okay, Meinke.
Meinke was in high-frequency engineering.
Yeah. So he, it was kind of like a... Don't ask, don't tell kind of situation.
Right. Yeah, well, he made it absolutely clear that it was my risk.
Uh-huh.
Not because he didn't want to help me, but if it would, if the other guy would find out, you know, I was so obviously violating the rules,
mm-hmm.
that I would have flunked,
mm-hmm.
no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to take the risk, and in fall of 1960, I wound up at Purdue University.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, did you choose Purdue?
No, the Fulbright Foundation chose, they paired people and universities.
Ah, I see.
The universities would offer positions
mm-hmm.
in certain departments, and then the Fulbright Commission would do that.
I see.
And
so once you accepted the scholarship, then you were going to go to
university. You were told which university to go to. And I crossed the Atlantic on boat, on the what we call the intermediate deck, you know, way down by the engines, of course, the cheapest ticket you could get. Mm-hmm. And on the way over, I was so incredibly seasick. Mm-hmm. It was a hard time for me.
How many days passage was that?
Oh, 6 days.
Uh-huh.
6 days from Land's End to Nantucket Island. All these things I remember because, you know, at our time. And then because I was somewhat late, Fulbright let me take a plane from New York to Indianapolis. Wow. My first time on a plane. You know,
it was
very exciting.
Yeah. So that was, got you there in time.
Yeah.
It must have been fantastic to be seasick all that time.
Yeah. But, you know, I was looking forward to paradise.
So,
yeah. It wasn't pleasant, but it was worth it, I thought, all along. Okay, so I arrived in at Purdue, and...
that was in October?
That was in October, October 1960.
1960.
Right.
Okay.
And I was told that because I had already passed my written exams back in Munich, that only half of the money I would get would be the real scholarship, and the other half I would have to earn as a teaching assistant. And so I taught a laboratory course there, you know, or supervision laboratory course. There was one younger professor who sort of took care of me. Mm-hmm. And in the second term, he said, you know, you could actually teach a recitation. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, but my English is not that good. He said, oh, your English is good enough. And it turned out that he had been standing outside of the classroom one or two times, listened to how I was doing without coming in, because he thought he would disturb me, you know, and I would get nervous.
So who is this guy, name?
Oh, I don't remember.
Ah.
There I must say...
perhaps it'll come, you know.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't remember.
But he helped you out and
oh yeah, you know, he was a real mentor.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there was a professor in magnetism who was a Jew of German descent.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to leave Germany before the war.
Mm-hmm.
He was lucky enough to leave Germany, I would have to say, as a young man. And he had a very strange attitude towards Germany. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, he was very proud.
Mm-hmm.
He was having this small radio set by Telefunken, the German radio set.
Mm-hmm.
He was driving a Mercedes at that time in the US, a very unusual car. At the same time, of course, he had resentments, which are totally understandable. And not so long after I had arrived, I was forced to take the prelim exams.
Mm.
I had never in my life taken a closed book exam. So I failed totally. I mean, no, it couldn't have been worse.
Mm.
And so then he called me into his office and got very, very angry with me, because he had originally said, well, wait, I was the first German student at the department after the war. He said, wait for the German student to come, you will see what a good student is. And here I failed totally.
So and he was unhappy.
He was very unhappy. I was very unhappy. But somehow this other young professor who was my mentor heard about it.
Mm.
So he called me to his office and said, you must understand, Fritz is the magnetics professor. he said, Fritz has a very hard time with Germany, so that's why it happens. Mm. And I said, but you know, I've never taken a closed book exam. Mm. He said, well, do you know how to prepare for these exams? I said, no. Well, he said, you know, if you go into the library in the back end or so, there are binders of all prelims of the last 10 years. Mm. What you do is you just take them and go through them, and that's the best preparation you can have, and you just take it over again in spring, and which I did. Mm. Then it was not a problem. Mm-hmm. Mm.
So what department did you go to?
Oh, it was electrical engineering.
So you're an electrical engineer.
Yeah, it was electrical engineering, but I specialized on statistical communication.
Statistical communication.
Yeah, right, cool. Right. There was a Professor Cooper, you know, that was just a very new field at that time. Mm-hmm. And that was shortly after the Shannon book was was published. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I must say, during that 1 year, I worked very, very hard because, you know, I had this threat that I might flunk my German exam. Mm. So, I decided to try to get a master's degree within the 1 year, the 2 semesters and the summer school. Mm-hmm. And so I took a very high work, and I had to, as a teaching assistant, after the spring, it was a half-time teaching assistant, originally it was a quarter, then it was a half-time. So I worked very hard, but on the one hand, there's not much to be done in Indiana, West Lafayette, Indiana, except some work. Also, I realized that, you know, I have a good background from home, mm-hmm. but I needed more practical knowledge in applications and so on, and it fit together very well. So I eventually did get the master's degree. So I hold a master's degree in electrical engineering.
From Purdue?
From Purdue University.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. And I think that the year at Purdue has had a very strong influence on the rest of my career and my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not only that I learned different attitudes toward engineering or towards learning, but, you know, it was a different language, it was a different culture, it was a different environment, it was, you know, it was something that I otherwise would have never been able to experience.
It's an education in its own right, just the time in a different country.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nowadays, to go to the United States is almost like going from here to Munich or so. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in those days, it was really very different. Mm-hmm. And during spring break, 4 of us, all Germans, one of them had a car. We went all the way down to New Orleans and then back up on the East Coast. Uh-huh. And in fall, after I finished the summer school, I bought a car and I went all the way with 2 other students all the way to California back.
Wow.
So I really got to learn the United States and the...
That was 61?
60, 61? That's 60, 61. Right. Mm-hmm. I came back in fall of 61. And on the way over, back over here, the sea wasn't so rough, so we had a great time on the boat, but it was, again, on the boat.
So what other experiences did you have in America at that time that you think are worthy recalling at this point? You socialized mostly with other German students, or...?
No. In fact, intentionally, I did not socialize with. There were 2 other Germans mm-hmm. at that time, and in fact, I shared the office with one of them. There were actually 6 desks in that mm-hmm. office, and he was sitting opposite to me. And we decided from the first day on that we would not speak any German unless it was absolutely necessary, you know, to make an appointment or something like that. Well. No, I socialized mostly with Americans, this was a little bit difficult, actually, because the majority of my fellow master's degree students were married already, and some of them had children already.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And for Germans at that age, and this was nothing.
You were, what, 30, 24, 26?
In 61, I was 25.
25, yeah.
And, you know, I had left my girlfriend back here in Germany, but, you know, we hadn't thought about getting married then, and most of them were already married and had children, so they invited me to their houses, but I couldn't return the invitation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also, it was difficult to get a date on the weekend because there were only the few home economics female students at Purdue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it was mostly work, I must say.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly work, but as I said, it had a strong influence on my on the rest of my life. And I'm very, very grateful to the Fulbright Foundation for that program and the opportunity I got that way.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity, and I guess they continue to offer those scholarships today to students around the world, which is really, really good.
So when I came back, I felt in a little more safer position because I had the master's degree. And if I was still flunked the diploma, it wouldn't be so bad. But because I had worked so hard for the master's degree, I had no time to work on my diploma thesis while in the U.S., so I had nothing when I came back. And so I went to see my mentor for the diploma thesis, and I think he was impressed that I got the master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
But
made
then,
good use of your time.
Right. So he realized I hadn't goofed off.
Yeah.
So he looked at me and said, "Well, what do we do now?" because the latest time point where you have to submit is about 6 weeks from now. So, well, in the end, he decided to write a letter to the examination committee that I had submitted a thesis that was so poor that he immediately returned it to me. He didn't even grade it.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you know, chances are that the guy will not remember your name and will not realize, which indeed happened. And the rules were that you could flunk your thesis once.
Ah.
Then you would get another half year to improve your thesis. And then turn it in.
So there's ways around the system.
right. And, you know, he was really very, very helpful.
Oh, yeah. But he obviously recognized...
Sorry. Just a second. Can you switch it off?
Oh, yeah.
Here we come. Yeah.
Okay, I think we're back underway here.
So
the fact that you had actually been very industrious impressed him enough to say, well, we could bend the rules for
I think so. It was close. He was a nice person, but I think he also acknowledged that I had made good use of that year in the United States.
And so you were able, that gave you another six months to work.
Right. So
but you're all doing this still in electrical engineering.
It was actually on vacuum systems.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't, as I said, you know, it was, in those days there were still vacuum tubes. Very important.
Oh, okay.
So it was on vacuum tubes and the seals, the vacuum seals in tubes.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe something that I forgot to say before, while I was still taking the courses in Munich, before I went to the United States, I spent a lot of time in the mountains. I was a mountain guide in the sports department of the Munich University. Mm-hmm. And most weekends I was out in the mountains climbing. Mm-hmm. And during the week I spent a lot of time at the music academy. Mm-hmm. Rather than in the technical university. Mm-hmm. I tried to follow my interests, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
So is your music in keyboard, or do you play a keyboard?
No, I played violin. Yeah, and one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my life was that during those 6 months, I had to work very hard. I stopped playing the violin, and also, we had a quartet, four students of us. All the other three were gone by that time. And there were different faces in the orchestra. Mm. So I gave up the violin playing, which I shouldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, you can do everything right. This was one of my big mistakes. Mm. Something that I did very right was that my girlfriend had waited for me. And she got a job in Munich as well, so she moved to Munich. Mm-hmm. And in a wedding ring, we usually have the date of the wedding and the date of the engagement. Mm-hmm. So in my ring, the engagement date is the day I left the boat when I was coming back from the US. Hers is about 6 weeks later, because she still had to find out whether that was the right thing to do. And we got married in 63. Mm-hmm. And then it was appropriate because I had finished my education. And her parents and my parents would think it was appropriate to be mm-hmm. married. Mm-hmm. And she has been my wife ever since. She's still my wife.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so we have 50th anniversary next year.
Excellent.
Wedding anniversary.
So you did spend a lot of time hiking in the like Bavarian Alps and the...
I mean, my free time.
Yeah.
But after I turned in my diploma thesis and got my diploma, I started to look for PhD work, as a grad student.
Okay.
And because I had been in statistical communication at Purdue, and I had become so interested in the biological side of the world, I thought I might try to find a PhD thesis in cybernetics. Mm-hmm. Which also was just coming up field at that time. Mm-hmm. And
So this was in, what did you call it again, in cybernetics?
Cybernetics.
Oh, cybernetics.
Cybernetics.
Okay.
So I went to, I tried to find out which university, at which university cybernetic work was being done. And I found out there were only two in Germany. One was in Tübingen and the other was in Bonn. Mm-hmm. And both had no openings. I went there and had an interview. So I was a little bit stuck there. And then I asked for interviews in other, maybe what I thought, related fields. And one of the interviews was with the head of the Department of Radiation Biology in Munich, at the University of Munich. And, we said, what do you want? And I said, well, I was actually looking for a place where I could do graduate work in cybernetics, mm-hmm. But I wasn't successful so far. He said, well, we don't do any cybernetics. But I just got a call yesterday from a man at the Federal Department of Science and Technology about something new. Do you know what a laser is? I said, no. I know what a maser is.
Yeah.
I've seen a maser at Purdue.
Yeah.
And a laser is apparently something similar. but I cannot claim that I know really anything about laser. Well, he said, there has been a report in New York Times of a medical doctor who claims that he could heal malignant melanoma with laser radiation. Mm-hmm. And the guy at the federal department asked me whether we would be interested in looking into that and find out what this was all about. And would you be interested to work in lasers? And I said, well, I don't know. I have to educate myself.
You have to find out what they are.
Right. So I went to the library and read some papers, you know, by people like Bloomberg and Maiman and Gordon and Boyd, mm-hmm. and all the Bell Laboratories people. Mm-hmm. And after 2 weeks or so, I thought it sounded like a very interesting field. Mm-hmm. And I went back to this professor and said, yeah, I was going to take it. Mm-hmm. And it was a job that was fully paid. You know, I got a full salary. So that was good. And it was actually not a job at the university department, but at a national research laboratory, somewhere outside of Munich. He had a double position in both. And so for the next 14 years, I was employed at the German National Laboratory on radiation and environmental research.
Mm. Now, you said that somehow along the way, previous to starting working your PhD, that you had become interested in biology.
Right.
So when did that come about? Where did that interest begin?
I think I just from listening to seminars, mm-hmm. or reading papers, and there was nothing special. Uh-huh. So, and it was very rudimentary at that point.
Oh yeah.
But when I joined that national laboratory, I made the point that I would go to any seminar I could go to get more knowledge.
Because you really had no formal education.
No, I had no formal education in biology, and I never got any formal education in physics, actually, in the basic laser physics. Mm-hmm. But then there was no laser physics at German universities. Yeah. Because the first laser was operated in 58, mm-hmm. and this was 62.
Yeah.
So it was, I would say, on the one hand, a difficulty, but on the other, it was a fantastic chance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a whole new field opened, and the ones who were in that field early on, you know, had a lot of options.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I said that the Fulbright year at Purdue influenced my further career very much. Mm-hmm. By the same token, I could say that lasers have been the common theme throughout all of my professional career.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I tried to understand as much about lasers as I could. And
so you're educating yourself in lasers and biology.
Yeah, right, right. But mostly on lasers at that point.
And you're working on a PhD program at that time?
Well, there were no formal lectures, so you just had to write a thesis.
Ah, okay.
And I was just, you know, starting to get to wet my feet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I read as much as I could, as I said, and after a couple of months, the professor called me in again and said, you know, what have you learned, and what do you think about applications with the malignant melanoma? Mm-hmm. And I said, to be honest, it doesn't sound convincing, but I must say it's non-ionizing radiation, and I don't know what the mechanism might be, how it would work, but I am not in a position really to tell you yes or no. Well, he said, I think you should talk to our dermatologist.
Mm.
So he made an appointment with the head of dermatology, in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there and presented my case.
Mm-hmm.
And he just burst into laughter and said, you know, this is incredible. These Americans, they always make claims that they can't live up to.
Mm-hmm.
This is a malignant melanoma. It's one of the most dangerous cancer there are.
Mm-hmm.
And
metastasizing
malignant melanoma,
mm-hmm,
is, there's no way that you can heal that.
Mm-hmm.
And so forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the guy, I just remember the name of the man who published that in the New York Times, his name was McGuff. Dr. McGuff.
M-C.
M-C-G-U-F-F.
McGuff.
McGuff.
Okay.
Yeah. He later almost lost his license because he had made these false claims.
Mm-hmm.
And he got out of it only because he could claim that at that time nobody really knew. Okay. So I went back to my mentor, my professor, and said...
But I mean, Luis, you understood that it probably wasn't going to work. I mean, it just from the reading that you had done, and you didn't...
Yeah, from the reading I had done, I was skeptical, because okay, I couldn't see mechanisms.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? And then the very experienced dermatologist told me, that people had tried almost anything on the malignant melanoma. It was clear that he knew what he was talking about, and that this would
then
work.
Your skepticism was proper and correct.
Right, right. So I went back to my mentor and said, yeah, Ron Farkle said, no way. And he said, yeah, that's what I thought already. So what do we do now? And then he said, do you think that lasers will ever be of any use in medicine? And I said, I don't really know, how can I know, but it's certainly a very interesting new principle, and it may well be of use and value, but it would take much more work to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, then let's go on.
Let's get to work.
Yeah, let's get to work. So, because he had the money, he got the money from the Federal Department of Science and Technology, and
spend it.
Yeah, why not spend it on something interesting?
Yeah.
So I started to work on lasers.
And this gentleman that have we gotten his name yet? The one that who said let's go on and who had the money?
Oh, Hug. H U G.
H U G.
Professor.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a medical doctor, but in radiation biology. So he was an MD.
Mm-hmm.
In radiation biology, that's important. So, he was very research oriented.
Mm, okay.
No, he was not a surgeon, let's say, for that matter, a dermatologist.
Mm, okay.
Okay, so the next question was how to get a laser.
Ha.
You couldn't buy lasers at that time.
Aha.
Huh? So, I had a fellow student who I met again after I came back from Purdue. And he had taken up a job at Siemens.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him one night and he said, well, I heard that a PhD physicist in the Siemens Research Laboratory is going to start a group on lasers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you should talk to him. And he gave me the name and I found out the telephone number and called this guy up and said, here I am and I would like to look at some potential medical applications of the laser, and I heard you're setting up a laser laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Could we talk to each other? And he said, oh yeah, why don't you come over? So I went there, and it turned out that at that time he was just by himself.
Mm-hmm.
There was no one else, and it was difficult to get one or two positions from the company for at least a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you could work for me. The only problem is that Siemens normally doesn't let people into their research laboratory who are not employees of
mm-hmm.
Siemens.
Mm-hmm.
but maybe we can try. So he said, why don't you just call the chief scientific officer, you know, for Siemens company,
way up,
and ask, and I'll write a letter and give it support or so. And it was difficult, but finally I got the permission. Lasers were at that time a magic word, you know, and even the CSO of Siemens had heard about lasers, and so for almost a year I was paid by the federal government and was officially at this national laboratory, but I worked at Siemens and built my own lasers. So I spent days polishing ruby rods, you know, they have to be very plain for a lot of faces, and fiddling around with flash lamps and reflectors, and it was a very interesting, very good time.
And who was the fellow at Siemens?
The fellow at Siemens was Dr. Russ, R O U umlaut double S.
Okay. Okay.
And we got along with each other very well, and he had some very good ideas. And I had some ideas. For example, there was towards the end of that year, there was the first publication on cue switching with rotating prisms, and it was not so easy to get a turbine that would be good enough for that. And it took us a while, and we got nervous because we wanted to see these cue switches. So I thought about it, and then I did something very simple. I took carbon paper. And at that time, there was still carbon paper for making copies. Cut it into a piece, and then put it into the optical resonator of the ruby laser. And then I pulled slowly back until part of the ruby rod was free to oscillate. And at that time, there was this buildup of inversion and of laser intensity, and it would burn the carbon paper. It was a perfect cue switch. It was a one-shot cue switch. But at least, you know, we could see what this was all about and so on.
A manual one-shot.
A manual one-shot cue switch.
So the cue switching was important in the laser business because of...
Well, we just wanted to be able to do as much of the experiments that people at Bell Labs in particular were doing.
Making sure that you could keep up with
all these developments. And so at the end, it was about 9 months or 10 months, I don't remember exactly. Russ, of course, for me he was Dr. Russ, who would never be his first name.
Yes.
Said, you know what, why don't you stay? I can get the money so Siemens can pay you. And he said, I have a clear goal. I want to be in the board of directors. I want to wind up in the board of directors of Siemens. If you stay with me, you can be in, in my shadow, so to speak. You know, you can pull up behind me, so to speak. And
right on my coattails.
Yeah, my coattails, right. You can be on my coattails, and you will have a chance of a very good career with Siemens.
Big money.
Big money. So I thought about it for a while, and that was the first time that I think I made a very conscious decision that I wanted to go into science. I didn't want to work for a company. I wasn't that interested in the big money. I wanted to do research and to do self-determined research, research that I really wanted to do. So I went back to this national laboratory, And
by then you knew enough to how to build your own laser.
Oh yeah, sure, sure. But then, actually, my first laser was the reflector, which mm-hmm. was a ellipsoid, was still made in the workshop, the machine shop of Siemens, mm-hmm. and they allowed me to take it out.
So this guy, Roos, did he get to the top of the heap like he said he was?
Almost. He went, in the end, his career took a different turn. Siemens has X number of daughter companies. And he became CEO of Heraeus daughter company, right? Which is, you know, in UV optics and, mm-hmm. and lamps and so on. Mm-hmm. So essentially, he
got what he wanted.
Yeah, right. And much later, maybe 10 years ago, he was also elected president of the German Physical Society.
Oh.
So, no, he was very... I was lucky to meet people who were personalities and were good at what they were doing. It was mm-hmm. These were good precedents for me.
And highly motivated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're back now at the National Lab.
I was back in the National Lab, and I was given... National Labs were very well funded in these years. Mm. So funding was not a problem. Like, whatever I wanted to buy...
So this was like mid-60s?
That was mid to end-60s. Started mid-60s until about the end.
Okay, so money was coming from the national government from
the federal government. Actually, 10% from the Bavarian state government and 90% from the federal government.
Okay.
At any rate, I still had to build my own ruby lasers, but soon thereafter you could buy helium neon lasers for mm-hmm. alignment, and then the first... argon lasers came, and a little later neodymium YAG. Mm-hmm. So slowly, lasers became commercially available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Then I gotta write these down for the YAG lasers. Yeah. Okay.
YAG argon. YAG was really a bit later, and I was. I developed the idea that most probably lasers would be particularly useful together with microscopes because you had a very collimated beam which you could easily focus down to small areas. Mm-hmm. So I set up a laser set with a microscope, and then something again very unusual happened. I was going to a Mardi Gras party in Munich.
Mardi Gras?
Mardi Gras, mm-hmm. yes, called Fasching. Mm-hmm. Fasching's party in Munich.
F-A-S-C-H-I-N-G. Fasching.
Fasching's party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why my wife wasn't with me. Oh, I guess our first son, who had been born in 66, she stayed home with the baby. Mm-hmm. Well, I went to that party, and it turned out to be relatively boring, and I saw a guy sitting in one corner drinking beer, and he looked bored as well, and I decided to just walk up to him and ask him who he was mm-hmm. and what he was doing there. So, turned out his name was Raymond Kaufmann. He is on the list of people that you have mm-hmm. pile up, mm-hmm. Collected who is who.
Mm-hmm.
Raymond Kaufmann.
Okay. So I, is his first name? Oh, we got him down.
Raymond R A I.
Yeah, M U N D. So this is Kaufmann, comma Raymond. Okay.
Right.
Very good.
So it turned out he was a physiologist.
Hmm.
With some physics background, and he was assistant, as we would call it, you know, how would you say that in English? Someone, you know, who gets a full salary and works at a department. Anyway, German assistant, okay? At the physiology department in Freiburg.
Okay.
And at that time, the concept of calcium antagonists.
Calcium antagonists.
As a remedy for infarction and circulation disease were very popular. And actually, his boss in Freiburg was the inventor of these calcium antagonists. So he was doing research on cell cultures of heart cells, heart muscle cells, and he was looking for a method to determine the distribution of calcium ions in heart muscle cells. Okay? And I said, and he had heard about lasers, you know. And I said, I have a laser, and I worked with it, and I have set it up with a microscope. So we decided, as we spent at least 2 or 3 hours just chatting there, and then we decided that the next week, while he was still in Munich, he would come to my office, in my lab, and we would discuss whether we could do some joint work. And this was, so to speak, the start of what, in the end, wound up to be MALDI. At the same time, I got an inquiry from the federal department again, whether I could do some work in laser safety. Because that was all of a sudden becoming a hot topic because there had been some accidents. So, and really, literally nothing was known about the interaction. So I got together with several people at the Munich Eye Clinic, because it was obvious that the eye was the main organs in danger. And and we started a series of experiments, animal experiments, on retinal coagulation. Now, about maybe 5-6 years before that time, an ophthalmologist in Spain and a German ophthalmologist then in Hamburg had both experimented with mirrors and sunlight for photocoagulation of the retina. And of course that was somewhat close to having a laser beam and focused on the retina. And their idea had been taken up by Zeiss company, and Zeiss was marketing a huge xenon lamp photocoagulator. It was a real monster. And at that time, every major eye clinic in the world wanted to have this. This was a big business for Zeiss at that time.
So the photocoagulation did what for the patient?
I mean, yes, that was...
What would it do to the eye, the photocoagulation?
Well, the xenon lamp with its power supply was about maybe 5 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And there was a sort of a beam coming out, and the patient would lie on the table underneath, and then the eye ophthalmologist would bypass with his vision, look into the eye, and manipulate the beam on the retina, and would heat up the retina to for photocoagulation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I mean, what was the benefit to the patient?
Oh, this was mostly used for so-called retinal ablation. There are certain diseases where the neural retina separates from the underlying retinal epithelium and choroidia. And it was actually called welding. It has nothing to do with welding, of course. What you do is you you damage the tissue, and the tissue will go through a wound reaction.
Ah, okay.
So, and in this wound reaction, unspecific tissue is formed that connects the two layers together. So the retina is gone where you coagulate, mm-hmm. but the surrounding is still functional. Yeah. So you would, if there's a hole in the retina, you would make many coagulations mm-hmm. around it.
Ah, that's right. And so they were using these huge,
this huge things
to get the xenon.
Okay, so we of course wanted to use lasers, and we decided that the first thing we needed to do was to understand how much energy, or we would put in, how much energy would get absorbed in the retinal epithelium. There is a one cellular layer which is highly pigmented, mm-hmm. it's the absorbing layer, and to get some feel for what was happening there.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one experienced ophthalmologist in that group, and he's on your list as well. It's Peter Gabel.
VP?
Yeah, VP Veit Peter.
Okay.
So he's the ophthalmologist.
Or E or E or I or how do you?
Peter, we're just, one R.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, the V stands for Veit, you don't need that.
Oh, okay.
Everyone calls him Peter Gabel.
And he was...
He was his ophthalmologist. Later was the chief of ophthalmology at the University of Regensburg, and he's now retired as well.
Okay,
and then, let me see, I hired Reginald Birngruber.
Okay.
Oops. So he's a physicist.
Okay.
And he was my first graduate student, so to speak.
Okay.
So I was his mentor from the very beginning. He came straight from university. And at that time I had several years of lab experience already.
Somewhere along here, did you take a PhD degree, or just...
Oh. Of course I did.
Okay.
I forgot about it.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about it. Okay, we come back to this later.
Yeah.
No, I, after we had managed to Q-switch our Ruby laser at Siemens,
okay.
we did get the spinning prism eventually, you know.
Okay.
Actually, when it was turned out to be too difficult, the one we wanted, we went into a shop and bought a dentist turbine. And put a prism on top of the dentist turbine.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out that you couldn't measure the energy in the Q-switch pulse because it would destroy any meter.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, a guy came who had been working at Bell Labs for 2 years or so, got a chair of physics at Technical University in Munich, mm-hmm. and he was also working with Q-switch lasers, mm-hmm. and somehow we got together, and I told him that I had some idea of how to measure that energy without damage to the meter. And so as my PhD thesis, I developed an energy meter for measuring the energy of Q-switched Ruby or other Q-switched lasers.
Okay.
And it consisted of aluminum cone which was darkened, and this is a very sturdy coating. It's not, you don't coat it with a paintbrush or so, but you anodize
aluminum.
And the main development was to add to these cones of different size, actually, some resistance wire for calibration.
Ah.
And the calibration procedure was complicated, but that Right, and I got my PhD in 66.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So this was while you were working at the National Lab.
Oh, I was working at the National Lab, but one of the head of the radiation department, IMA, the radiation department, also had a chair at the Technical University.
Okay.
So he never understood anything about lasers, but he was kind enough to accept my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Asked another colleague to serve on the committee, that way I got my PhD. I think somewhere in your list there, mm-hmm. you asked already about my mentors.
Mm-hmm.
In the classical sense of the mentor, I never had one.
Mm-hmm.
I was a self-made man. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had like this guy in electronics, mm-hmm. you know, the vacuum electronics,
mm-hmm.
who was very friendly and helped me a lot, and Hook helped me a lot,
mm-hmm.
but they couldn't give me any advice as mm-hmm. far as my research.
How to direct your program yeah. for
you. So, you know, this is, if you pick up something like I did with lasers, on the one hand, the field is wide open and you have a lot of options what you can do. On the other hand, you're on your own.
Yeah, you have no guidance, no help.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so you gotta.
Right. I don't know, are we getting too much into detail?
No.
Is
no,
it okay?
Good. Yeah, this is very good, because I mean, that's what we want, is to find these little things. I mean,
yeah.
anybody can pick up the literature and read all these papers and find out about the science, but you know, this is about how the science got to be.
Okay.
Yeah. It's about, and that's what we're about here.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
But, you know, otherwise you let me know.
Oh, okay. We're good.
Speed a little bit. So it was actually with this group from the Munich Eye Clinic that the laser tissue interaction became my major topic at that time in my research. We, for example, we prepared, we took first rabbit eyes, they were cheap, then monkey eyes, which were not so cheap. And then later even human eyes, which had to be enucleated, taken out because of tumor.
Mm-hmm.
As I told you, behind the retina is one cellular layer, mm-hmm. very sensitive, highly pigmented with melanin mm-hmm. to absorb light.
Mm-hmm.
And we prepared that single layer under a microscope and measured the absorption.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out the absorption isn't in any way uniform throughout the eye background, the fundus. It varies a lot, and partly because of different pigmentation, partly because of different geometry. You know, mm-hmm. the fovea, which is the area of where you see in focus,
mm-hmm.
Is somewhat indented in the retina, and it looks much darker than it really is.
So these are eyes that had been removed from the animals?
Yeah, well, we started out with rabbits.
Okay.
For these experiments, we would take the eyes from the animal.
Mm-hmm.
We also took eyes, had a special holder, which made sure that the curvature of the cornea stayed exactly what it was in the live animal,
mm-hmm.
and then in the back of the eye we drilled a little hole, and then we scanned the laser beam there, because the eye is in no way a perfect optical system, and nobody knew what the size of the focus really was on the retina,
mm-hmm.
so we measured that.
Mm-hmm.
These were the more basic basic experiments. At the same time, we irradiated live animals, and then made follow-up studies of how the retina would develop, and in the end would sacrifice the animal, take the eyes out, and do histology and electron microscopy.
So this was all to develop information that you would use to determine the laser energy to do the photocoagulation thing in, as a medical
right treatment. You know, we started out by trying to answer the question, how dangerous were lasers, under what conditions, on what in what wavelength range, what pulse range, and what organ. But it really developed into experiments and research into the basic interaction mechanisms. For example, in dermatology, the there's also, of course, pigments, there's melanin there, but in dermatology, the arteries and veins are very important. And can you close, for example, arteries in bleeding wounds, so with lasers? And you know, all this has to do with biology. You have to understand the tissue that you're irradiating and its function. But it's a lot of physics also. You have to do good radiometry, and you have to become an expert in histology and electron microscopy. So this was a very fruitful collaboration, and let me look at that list where there's someone else on your names list who... No, I think on this list it's only... Those two are indeed the most important collaborators.
Very good.
And since that was going quite well, I was asked by the Federal Department of Science and Technology, the guy who started the whole thing out came one day into my laboratory and said, what can we do to get more information about laser medical applications and to foster that field? And I said, well, it definitely needs a collaboration between physicists and medical doctors. So far, we are doing most of our experiments in the eye clinic, but every second time that we decide in the afternoon we do some experiment, the ophthalmologist will get called to a patient and we can't do the experiment. So my suggestion would be to set up a medical laser laboratory at the National Laboratory, equip it with all common lasers that we knew were useful for medical applications at that time already, and hire one or two or three physicists like Reginald Birnberger to make sure that the lasers are operating properly, and then ask medical doctors to come out there, which is far enough away from their clinics that they can't be called for emergency cases or so that one can do real decent experiments. And in the end, there were five or six different medical doctors in different specialities involved. There was urology, neurology, gastroenterology, ophthalmology, and one of them actually took a year of leave from his clinic, and he served as the chief MD at that laboratory.
So you had him full time.
Right. And that was, I think, the precedence for what still is the biggest and most successful laboratory on medical laser applications and other optical techniques in medicine, actually, which is the Wellman Center of Photomedicine in Boston. I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Let's leave that for the moment. You know, I don't want to do any shoulder slapping, but we had managed at that time to be most probably the leading group on laser tissue interaction worldwide. In 1970, I attended my first Gordon Research Conference on lasers in medicine and biology. And until 4 years ago, I've attended every single such conference. I chaired one of them myself and had very, very fruitful interaction with groups from all over the world.
Now, is this conference in the fall or in the spring? Usually they have a...
That is in fall or late summer, let's say.
East Coast?
East Coast. Yeah. Until very recently, it was always at Kimball Union Academy, which is in New Hampshire, upstate New Hampshire, near what's the Ivy League University up in Vermont? Dartmouth College.
Dartmouth.
It's very close to this. Of course, the Gordon Conference were all held at prep schools.
Yeah.
And this was close to Dartmouth College, but on the New Hampshire side.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
So you've been going to these for the last 30, 40 years?
Yeah. It has been going on since, I think the first was 69 or so. And it, not every year. It was, when I started, it was every year. And then I actually was the one who suggested it should be every second year because there was not enough new material to warrant it every year. And I at this conference also I met John Parrish. Is he on your list? I guess he's not because he's only the Germans. So maybe you want to add. Certainly his name and one more name. John Parrish, P-A-R-I-S-H. Yeah.
Double R. Okay.
John Parrish is a very extraordinary man. He was educated as a dermatologist and spent 1 year in Vietnam doing triaging. Very, very. You know what triaging is?
Triage?
Triage. You say triage or triage?
Triage.
Triage, okay, triage. Good. So, which is important if you want, if you know him well. He suffered from that much later. But he had also started to be interested in medical laser applications in dermatology, actually. And we met at one of the Gordon conferences, and I gave a paper on laser tissue interaction. And he came to me afterwards and said, we are trying these applications, and we don't really understand much about this field. Would you be willing to help us with that? And I said, yeah, why not?
Sure.
And then the next thing that happened was that the spring thereafter, they had a, how do you call that? They went out for a weekend to Cape Cod to discuss their research program.
A retreat?
A retreat, right. Right, so they had a retreat, and he invited me and paid for my trip across the Atlantic.
Wow.
And and this was so fruitful. Actually, the most fruitful was the car ride. He picked me up at the airport and drove me right out to Cape Cod. This car ride was essential for a lot of work that we did together later on, because we decided that what was happening was there was a big gap between the physics and the metrology of lasers here and the tissue on the other side. And in order to bridge that gap, you have to have very good physics and do very good measurement, and on the other hand, have very good, particularly electron microscopy. So and then try to establish a relationship between the physical action and the biological reaction. And so for many years, the photopathology at Raman was the center pillar of the whole thing, besides the physics, of course. So John was the MD, but he never really worked in the laboratory. The physicist is Rox Anderson, who is now director of the Wellman Laboratory. You want to put down his name? Rox, R-O-X, Anderson, just as you. Okay.
This is all on the drive out to Cape Cod.
Right. I mean,
then
we had at this weekend with many more discussions, and as a result, you know, I was appointed first consultant John had been able to set up a group and a laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
But it was small and just a few people. At that time, he was still seeing patients. And he had, I don't know where, why actually, had the idea that one could use light to treat psoriasis.
Wow.
You know psoriasis,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with a treatment called PUVA. Zurulin UVA radiation, and he got permission from the authorities, which is NIH, or Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, FDA. Probably FDA. Yeah. I think.
Yeah. Anyway, he got permission for an experimental treatment of 20 or so patients with this UV light. Mm-hmm. And zurulins are organic aromatic compounds.
Mm-hmm.
The actual story goes back to the old Egyptians. It's already in their texts
mm-hmm.
that they describe that certain workers in the field never have skin diseases. And it turns out that they were working with plants that generate these zurulins.
What do they call these?
Zurulins. Let me type it.
No, one of those.
Zurulins.
Zurulins. Okay.
Yeah. They actually are cross-linking molecules between the two DNA strands.
Okay. So if you work in the field with plants with these compounds,
right. they had a natural protection.
Hmm.
Okay, so he got this permission to do a number of patients, and after he had collected the 20 of them, a lady came and said, "Could she still?" He had advertised that. Could she still be part of it? And he said, well, you know, I have already 20 and I'm not allowed to do anymore.
Mm.
But she begged him very, very strongly and said, you know, I have psoriasis all over the body. And so he said, well, the only thing I can do is put you on the wait list. And then within a week or so, someone dropped out. So this lady was admitted to the controlled study. And it turns out that she was an extremely good reactor.
Hmm.
She reacted very positively. She lost all of her psoriasis.
Wow.
And lost it for the rest of her life.
Wow.
Weeks later or so, a guy called John Parrish and said, you want to see him? And he said, yes, why? Well, he said, you treated my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And we are so happy about this treatment. Could I stop by your laboratory? So he came, it was Mr. Wellman. And he said, you know, we want to support you. Do you need something for your work that I can help you with? And John said, well, I would like to have a monochromator.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about $20,000. That may be too much. No, he said, just order it, send me the bill, I'll pay for it. And, you know, the check will be written and the lot. A day later, the Director General of Massachusetts General Hospital called John and said, you know, I understand you have talked to Mr. Wellman. John said, yes. I understand you have asked for a monochromator from Mr. Wellman. John said, yes, that's true. Was that too much? I wasn't sure what to do. And then the other guy burst into laughter. Turns out Mr. Wellman was one of the oil tycoons. Mm-hmm. Very, very rich. Mm-hmm. He actually lost all his money later because he was a gambler, I mean, on oil. Mm-hmm. During the first oil crisis, he lost most of his work. But it turned out that later on, he financed one of the huge research buildings at MGH, mm-hmm. Michigan Hospital. And one level was given to John, and he got quite a bit of money from Wellman. So that was the start of the Wellman Center of Photomedicine.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And Wellman would come once or twice a year and walk through the laboratory for a day or two and enjoy that he was, you know, somehow involved in this research and that he could finance it. Also, relatively early on, John got a call from Department of Defense, DOD, mm-hmm. And the guy said, well, we have spent already a lot of money on the development of a free electron laser. Mm-hmm. And there is actually, well, whether you said it the first time, I don't know, but it turns out there was when this free electron laser was part of Star Wars, Reagan's Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And there was a note in the decision of Congress that 10% of the money must be spent to look into other than military applications, particularly medicine and what was the other? And materials research, yeah. Mm. So, and by then, you know, the guy had heard about this group at Harvard, and would he be willing to take part in that program? And I was there at that time, just by circumstance, and John was coming to my office and told me the story and said, what do you think? And I said, well, I first have to educate myself about the free electron laser and its parameters. And then I think there will be big problems because as far as I know, the faculty here, they won't be very happy getting involved in Star Wars and so on. So I looked into this. It was a very special type of free electron laser developed by John Mahey at Stanford. And it turned out it was, on paper at least, wavelengths tunable in the UV with a picosecond structure, which was at that time a very strange and not at all explored parameter range. So it was scientifically interesting, but there was still the problem of Star Wars.
Yes.
And then John and I both talked to the rest of the group, and we said, you know, at least this money is being used for something peaceful mm-hmm. rather than for destroying something. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's part of Star Wars shouldn't really bother us so much, and if we tie some strings to it. So finally, the end of it was that we submitted a proposal, and it's clearly stated that, first of all, we could not predict and promise any useful medical applications of the laser, but we would try, and secondly, that every single thing we did was going to be published.
Ah.
So they could not keep anything secret. Mm-hmm. That convinced the others. In the end, I think the free electron laser program went on until 2 or 3 years ago, and the Wellman Center got at least $50 million from that program alone. Mm. and a lot of interesting and good work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always in that, in those applications as a consultant,
mm-hmm.
you know. However, after the first 2 or 3 years, I was also appointed visiting professor at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and I kept that position for at least 20 years, even though there is nothing like a continued visiting professor at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow John managed that, I don't
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
It was important for me because I could use this as an argument towards my university here uh-huh. to spend 2 or 3 months a year in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So this is that side of my activities, which is really related to laser tissue interaction and medical laser applications.
Mm-hmm.
And I still maintain some of those activities in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1976,
mm-hmm.
I moved from Munich to Frankfurt.
Okay,
and
so all this time, you know, this development was occurring during that early time frame, early 70s, when you were...
Right. Most of it was done in the time between 63 and 76.
Okay.
Okay.
While you were still in Munich.
Why I was still in Munich, right. But already at that time, I spent some time in Boston, so you know, I was commuting back and forth. But my main occupation was in Munich.
Yeah.
What happened was that I was moved from one department in the National Laboratory to another department, which was newly founded, and the chief of that department and I didn't get along. So I started to look around for other positions and took up an associate professorship at the University of Frankfurt.
Okay.
For medical physics and biophysics, and my teaching obligation there was teaching physics to the medical students and biophysics to the physics student. So I had a very heavy teaching role there.
Yeah. Did you teach any at Munich?
In Munich, at the National Laboratory, there was no teaching,
mm-hmm.
but I had a part-time teaching job at the University of Maryland. I think I told you the other night.
Okay.
The University of Maryland was operating a campus in Munich for children of what they call government dependents.
Mm-hmm.
It was either military
mm-hmm.
or diplomatic personnel
sure.
or other government dependents.
University of Maryland in Munich. Okay.
Yeah, right. University of Maryland in Munich. And it was a junior college, so it was only the first...
Mm-hmm.
First 2 years.
So you taught there?
I taught physics there. One semester of physics for non-science students and then physics for science students. It was 4 hours of teaching per week and 4 hours of laboratory work.
But this was on the side, it wasn't a requirement.
It was on the side, I needed permission to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very well paid, I must say, and it gave me a chance to keep up with my English.
Mm.
You know, it was very good. But
you sought this job out yourself, though.
Yes. I don't remember how I heard about that university, and after I heard about it, I just went there and talked to the dean, and after maybe 15 minutes of talk, he said, you know, but with your background, why do you think you would be qualified to teach German here
mm-hmm.
to our students?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I don't want to teach German. I thought I would teach physics.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he said, that's very different. So, so then for, I think, 2 years, there was another American there, a PhD, who, and I was his assistant, so to speak. I did the laboratory courses, and then he left for the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and I took over the lecture and the laboratory.
So this was a fairly small group of students?
Oh, yeah. The total number of students on the Munich campus was something like 500, I think.
Well,
around that, yeah. But
that.
In the physics course, there were never more than 20,
yeah.
mostly 12 or so.
Yeah.
So it was always a question, you know, could they afford me to teach the physics course?
Yeah,
because there were a small number of students.
Yeah, that's always a problem.
Yeah. I learned to teach, by the way, there,
sure.
You know, and also to deal with some other problems. In 1 year, they had a huge problem with drugs. Because the whole thing was on a military base in the city of Munich, and there was drug dealing going on the base, and the students became aware of it. And in one semester, more than half of the students failed. Would you believe it? I taught, and it was obvious that some of my students were involved in that as well, particularly one girl who was a very good student, and all of a sudden she almost dropped out. And so I one day asked her to stay and talk to her, and she said, yeah, I was right, but I shouldn't worry, next semester it would be over and everything would be normal again. I didn't believe it, but it happened. It was very strange.
Yeah, it is strange.
Yeah, it was methadone that they were taking mostly.
So that was just for that one period?
It was just this sort of, you know, it was fashionable.
Yeah.
But those were, the students were strong enough already in their personality that they could pull out. Most probably a few of them got lost.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so I did teach there, and then I, in Frankfurt, I taught.
But that was a more responsible world in a way, because, you know, now you're in a university setting.
Now I was in a normal German university, and this was a normal step in the career.
Yeah.
In fact, many people remain associate professor for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. They don't have to necessarily become a full professor at German university.
So, but I mean, you got kind of the worst of both worlds. And, I mean, you were teaching medical students about physics and physics students about biology. So, I mean, that's kind of like, was it?
Yeah, but it's also, I got something out of it, because the medical students just hate physics, and for their sort of prelims that they have to take, physics is the worst of all fields. And to try to get across to them where physics is important in medicine. I mean, you know, ionizing radiation is obvious, it is simple. But for example, that you have a layer of surfactants in your lung, and if the lung, first of all, when a baby is born, it has to inflate the lung,
right?
And if it wouldn't be for the
surfactants,
the lung would rupture before it would ever inflate. And, you know, and I made it my point to, for every single part of physics, to show them, you know, where that was important.
In medicine.
Yeah, in medicine. And, it was a high teaching role, but it was also quite good. And for the physics students, they were only taught about ionizing radiation, and so I added a part non-ionizing radiation and optics and all that, and that was worthwhile as well. So
how many hours did you end up teaching? Was that
Well, there's also there was the laboratory for the medical students, which was running 4 hours every afternoon throughout the semester. And I had to mentor two or three groups there every afternoon. So in total, it was about 14 hours.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, that was quite a bit. By the way, we had also a very good lab course for the medical students.
No.
For example, I talked Zeiss into letting us have a number of not most modern stereo microscopes, and they are now used in almost every operating field, you know, in ophthalmology, in surgery, in gynecology, and so on. And to make sure that you have stereo vision on a stereo microscope is not so easy. So from my work back in ophthalmology, back in Munich, I knew that when you make a corneal transplant, you sew it on with a very fine needle, and actually, originally it was hairs that they were using. Later on, it was very, very thin nylon threads. And so I got hold of a couple of needles, and they're bent actually, and of the thread. And I asked the students to feed the thread through the eye of the needle. And unless you have good stereo vision, you just can't do it. But it was something, you know, it was written in the description of the experiment that whoever would go into ophthalmology might need that. And things like that. Or we had a trough with liquid and electrolytes to mimic EKG. And then we also had a simple medical EKG apparatus there, so the students were taking EKGs of each other and things like that. So you know, it's worthwhile trying to convince even medical students that physics is good for something.
Well, yes, but I mean, that's the right way to teach it, to understand, you know, the reason why you want to know these things, because they can be helpful.
But you see, if it wouldn't have been for the MDs that I associate with in Munich, and Raymond Kaufmann, who was a physiologist, and knew everything about the human body, I couldn't have done that. So that was a prerequisite for setting up the lecture that way. And so, but in Frankfurt, I never found a single MD who was interested into laser applications. So I got stuck there. That's why I shifted all my activities on medical laser applications to Boston.
Okay.
So that was, since then, it's in Boston, a little bit here, but not much. And parallel to this medical laser applications in Munich, as I told you, I met this guy Kaufmann, and after quite a number of discussions, we decided that the only, or the most probable approach would be to not only combine a laser with a microscope and focus it to a size that is smaller than a cell, but add a mass spectrometer to see what ions you have there. And
You said the magic word, mass spectrometer.
Right. So, this was the first time mass spectrometry entered my life.
Right then. But I mean, this was an idea that you had, or that was, that came out as a result of discussions?
No, it came out of discussions. No, we were, you know, it was the laser and focusing and microscope part. Raymond would have known about, but I had the practical and the hands-on experience. So I said, that can be done. And then we were looking for a way to measure what we were generating there in terms of ions. And there were several publications at that time where people were using emission spectroscopy, optical emission spectroscopy. But, you know, we did some calculations, and it was clear that that would not be sensitive enough.
Right.
And it was too limited to only a few ions that might be there. So,
but I mean, did you have an understanding that the interaction of the laser with the biological material would actually produce ions?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
It was a guess. Yeah, not quite. Let me explain to you how that all evolved.
Okay.
What I knew, of course, was by that time that you could use high intensity lasers in a focus. It's always high intensity. That you could generate a plasma.
Okay.
And of course, there are ions in the plasma.
Right.
And we were interested in atomic ions, you know, sodium, potassium, calcium, iron, all the trace elements.
Okay.
Okay. So our notion was that we would focus the laser on a tissue section.
Okay.
Or cell from cell culture on an electron microscopic grid would generate a plasma and look at the ions in the plasma by mass spectrometry.
But there you were interested in ions of basic elements.
Atomic ions.
Right.
Huh?
Right.
We didn't even think of molecular ions then.
Okay.
That was atomic ions.
Yeah, okay.
And because, you know, he was originally interested in the calcium.
Right. He goes back to the calcium in the cell.
Yeah, calcium in the cell for the calcium antagonist.
Because he wanted to know where the distribution of calcium ions was.
Right. So, at that time, I had already been moved to the new department, and my then boss thought that was all totally crazy, and he was not willing to put any money into that.
Now you're in Frankfurt.
No. That was still in Munich.
Oh, still in Munich.
Oh, yeah. The work started around 1970, I guess.
Okay.
May have written it down there. Okay, so we decided to write a proposal to VW Foundation.
VW Volkswagen. Yeah.
They have a foundation and they fund research.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went through relatively great lengths to not only explain why we wanted to do what we wanted to do, but also how it would work, you know, and why it would work.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have to look for something here. Okay, we were quite confident that we would get the money.
Okay.
And indeed, after a couple of months, we got a letter and we got the money. Much later, 20 years later, we met the officer who was responsible for deciding which proposals would get granted and which not.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked him, you know, this was a pretty risky project. Why? What made him decide to give us the money? And he said, you know, I had been sitting there on a Friday. It was a whole day, and I had looked through something like 10 proposals. They were all well written, they were all okay, but they weren't really fascinating. There was nothing really new about it. And, you know, it was continuing something that people had been doing, where feasibility had been done, and they knew how to do it. And I said, God damn it, I once wanted to fund something that is really high risk, high yield. So he realized that if that would work, then that might be very useful. So, and this, despite, of course, he had written evaluations. And I can tell you now what it said. It said, this project touches the absolute limit of sensitivity, which has not been achieved before and will in all likelihood not be achieved by this project either. So he was courageous,
yes,
in a way. At the same time, he wanted to cover his back as well. So in the allowance letter, it also says, after proving basic feasibility within, in accepting this support, You have to accept the responsibility for the high risk to successfully complete this project.
Mm-hmm.
So he let us know, you know, we better be successful. So we set up the whole thing in a room, actually outside of the department that I belonged to, because my boss didn't want to see that there, and added actually to the laser and the microscope, we added a quadrupole mass spectrometer, which we which Balzers loaned us. We didn't pay for it, and then we took a cover glass, a microscopic cover glass, and evaporated aluminum onto it and put it in our machine and banged it with the laser. And we found out that we needed something like 1,000 shots to just trace out the aluminum peak in the mass spec, and it took forever. It was a full day or so just for this little bit. So we quickly decided a quadrupole wasn't the right thing to do. The other thing we realized was that our notion of generating a plasma was totally wrong. So we sort of did the right thing, and this will come up again later, we did the right thing for the wrong reason. If we cranked up the laser to the point that we generated plasma, we saw, you know, big humps of whatever, something, which we couldn't make any sense of. So this was when the laser desorption was born. We found out you have to be just at the border where you perforate, let's say, a tissue section or a cell or so, but not much more. And then you could see the ions we wanted to see.
So it was just a matter of getting it just right.
It's the right fluence or radiant exposure, irradiance, there are different terms. Intensity, if you want, so, though that's very unspecific. Also, since it was clear that we should not use too high a laser power or energy, we looked at different tissues, and originally we just made blood smears, you know, and we saw that with the Ruby laser that I had for erythrocytes, for red blood cells, that worked very nicely, but for white blood cells it didn't. So and the reason was that in order to perforate the white blood cells or anything else that was non-absorbing at the Ruby laser wavelengths, we needed much too much laser energy. And so I added a frequency doubler to the Ruby laser, so we went from 694 nanometers in the far red to 347 nanometers. And I don't know, you know, I have prepared a number of pictures. Do you want to look at them now?
That would probably be fine.
Because, you know, some of that, then you can transfer it to your, maybe you switch that off for the moment. If it doesn't bother you. First of all, since we were talking about the Gordon conferences, this is John Parrish. This is at an afternoon, you know, at Gordon conferences, the afternoon is always free. So we went on a hike for one of these mountains there, and we did many hikes together, actually. White Mountains and so on. So this is one of my students. Did his experimental PhD work with a free electron laser at Vanderbilt, and this is Richard Haglund on a different This is a different Gordon conference. This was the Gordon conference on lasers that was in medical laser applications. So you know, there was a certain pattern to mm-hmm. my going to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll come back to that later. On your list is Peter Rebsdorf.
Ah, okay.
This was when we got the ABRF award in Denver,
mm-hmm.
and he was there, and we were just sitting in front of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I think my wife did shoot this, and just to show you how much I'm part of the group in Boston, the development faculty. It's like a professional second home when this happened with my wife. I had to write a few weeks ago. I had to cancel one of the trip and tell them why. So they sent me this and...
Very nice.
Yeah, so this is the... and it was taken when I was there, maybe last year or so, mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly. So this is where there's Rocks. No, there's Rocks Anderson.
Mm.
And Romper is no longer anymore because he retired from that. But these were just, I brought them from home. These are not the other photographs I wanted to show to you. Okay, these are just PowerPoint slides, but they can be transformed to digital photos. This is the what I just read to you. This project is at the limit mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. possible. Of course, it was written in German.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and. Okay, these are red blood cells, okay, and these are perforations, and with laser,
mm-hmm.
it was done under laser, and this was a free-run ruby, and this was a Q-switch ruby, and you see that to some extent the action of the Q-switch is more vigorous,
mm-hmm.
Because you get bigger holes.
Mm-hmm.
Still, for other reasons, we had to stick with the 10 nanosecond Q-switch laser because otherwise you couldn't frequency double.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, these are pigmented. They have hemoglobin, right?
Right.
This is a non-pigmented cells, and you see the three holes here, which were done at 347. You see these holes?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a granular cell, so it's a little bit difficult to see, but mm-hmm. that's where it is. And it's a phase contrast. And you see this was now 20 nanoseconds and Q-switched
mm-hmm.
Laser and frequency doubled. This now was the first instrument which, this is still in Munich, from which we got presentable results, let's mm-hmm. say. We decided to do away with the quadrupole and go for time of flight. And see, there is a vertical time of flight tube,
mm-hmm.
and the laser is back here, and well, the electronics are there. But at that time, we had to record all the spectra on the trip chart recorder.
Mm-hmm.
There was no transient recorders available at that time. That came quite a bit later. So, and here's the microscope, you know. So we essentially took the microscope apart into pieces and assembled it on top of the time of flight tube. As I said, the objects were thin tissue slices mm-hmm. as you produce them on the microtome. And of course, there must have been a vacuum seal there.
Mm-hmm.
And the feed through, the vacuum feed through, were just spark plugs from a car. Because we didn't want to wait too long for high voltage feed throughs.
Yes.
In fact, they were difficult to get at that time, so we just used power plugs. And
it worked, I guess.
Yes,
of course. Worked well.
Yeah, it worked well. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. I like that.
Except that they're more difficult to seal because they have a somewhat conic thread.
Thread. It's not well designed for a vacuum system, but.
So and this system we call NAMA for laser microprobe mass analyzer.
Okay.
So this is the first LAMA instrument ever set up, and again this was for elemental or atomic ions.
Right.
Only, okay. So let's.
Were you even thinking about molecular ions at all?
No, at that time we didn't think about molecular ions at all, and I'll tell you in a moment how that came about. At any rate, after VW Foundation had financed the feasibility experiment, and we had proven that even though the mechanism is different, it was doable, VW said, we are not going to continue to finance projects. We just want to get seed money. Mm-hmm. So we had to look for other funding, and went back to the Federal Department of Science and Technology, and they said, yeah, they would be willing to finance it if we would team up with a company. Mm. So we went around a variety of companies. Of course, obvious choices were the optical companies, lights and sights, sights and lights, and then Balzer for the vacuum technology. Mm. And none of them was willing to enter into an enterprise like that. But we finally came to Leibold Hereus in Cologne, which was originally a company that made equipment for physics teaching in schools.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had done some vacuum equipment and so on, and they were willing to join in with us. And they built commercial instruments, the one for the thin slices, that was our interest for tissue slices, was called the LAMA 500.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were also interested in using it for semiconductor chips. Look at failures in their chips, and that was then not a transmission arrangement, but an arrangement where the laser beam was coming under an angle and the ions were extracted under a different angle, and this was called the LAMA 1000. And this is the final version of the LAMA 1000 as they sold it. In total, I think they sold something like between 50 and 70, I don't know the numbers of these instruments. At that time, already half a million Deutschmarks each. So it was not a big business, but it was a fairly successful business. Then the company decided to stop their whole program on vacuum technology and analytical instrumentation, and the LAMA went down the drain with that. So this is the LAMA 1000, there it says in the slides here. Okay, this is in a very early time, this is Hermann Kaufmann, that's the only picture I could find of him. He was just 2 years my senior, and this is somewhere in the laboratory, I'm soldering some circuitry, and he's just watching, very skeptical. He was very bright, but very critical, and you had to have a strong ego to survive with him. If you had a strong enough ego, then it was a very, very fruitful collaboration. But he was too impatient to deal with people who said just yes when he said something. You know, you have to fight a little bit. Okay, that's
right. I'll be able to get an electronic copy of this. Right.
Yeah. These are, as I said, these are PPT files.
Yeah.
And we transfer them after. Sure. Okay. Now, over the last few years, imaging molding has become one of the major fields of application of molding. We couldn't do really imaging molding, but the idea we had already and did it then, this is a kidney tissue section, and these are these little tubes in there where the exchange of electrolytes takes place.
Okay.
And we wanted to look there where the potassium and the sodium is, of course, driven by by the electric potential. And there you see we looked at different areas here, and but for every single shot we had to take a spectrum on the strip chart recorder and then take a ruler afterwards to measure what ion it was. So it was very tedious and certainly not practically useful at that time.
Well, it's like the early mass spectra that were taken, where you adjust the magnetic strip current and then you get a point and you just...
Yeah, or photo plates, you know, and looked at that. So the ideas were there already, but the time wasn't, at that time, wasn't right.
And the technology was...
Right. Actually, you know, what happened was we had this very fast oscilloscope, Tektronix, and it had only a 4 by 6 centimeter screen, and not every shot was a success, of course.
Yeah,
you can imagine. So, you know, I would be sitting there, getting my eyes dark adapted for 10 minutes or so, and then fire the laser, and then zip.
Yeah.
And also something passed by, and you had to be very fast to see whether it was worthwhile to capture that or not capture it. And we had these very sensitive Polaroid films, which lasted in only in the refrigerator, and then only for 4 weeks or so. So we kept ordering them. So it was not a high throughput method by then, but you know, it worked on tissue section.
What year would that work have been there?
This was still in Munich, so that would be something like 73, 74, I would imagine. And this is, I added this, it's nothing to do with Lama, this is work on the rabbit eyes. You see the rabbit here? Yeah? And the laser is here, and then there's a fiber optics, and we guided it into the rabbit eye. In fact, in this particular case, we wanted to know how dangerous Q-switch lasers were, not only on the retina, but also on the eye lens. So we focused into the eye lens and generate these huge bubbles here. Of course, this again is a histology after we took the eye out. And it also tells a story. We presented that at an ophthalmology conference and said, you know, this shows that one should be even more careful with Q-switch lasers because it can produce much more damage than the free run. And so, you know, stay away from Q-switch lasers, so to speak. Only 2 years later or so, independently, an ophthalmologist, a woman in Paris, and an ophthalmologist who we had actually collaborated with in Switzerland, in Bern, found out that you could use these Q-switch lasers to cut membranes in the vitreous. And this is now a standard method in ophthalmology. So we missed out on that. We've only looked at the danger and didn't think enough about the potential use of that. That's why I put it in here. Okay, so that much at the moment for Lama. When I moved on to Frankfurt, I took the Lama 500 instrument along because that belonged to me and not to the National Laboratory because I had brought in the money. And after 2 or 3 years, Leibold had finished their first prototype of the Lama 1000, And that was set up in my laboratory in Frankfurt as well. And so in Frankfurt, we used the... let me say it differently. I had an agreement with Raymond Kaufman that he would pursue more the biological applications, and I would pursue more the applications of such a microprobe in material science or physics. So, and among others, what we did was look at, we took carbon foils or metal foils and looked at the cluster distribution. That was also a very popular field of research in those days, by SIMS, by plasma desorption, by many different methods. You know, if you have carbon, for example, pure carbon foil, just graphite, and you bang it with a laser, then you get a distribution of carbon 1, carbon 2, carbon 3, carbon 4, and so on. So, if you want, so they're molecular ions, but they're... that's not what they're called.
Yeah, they're clusters.
Clusters, right. Yeah. And published quite a number of papers on clusters.
Go ahead, that's fine.
Yeah, there is also, and we saw differences between, let's say, SIMS and laser. We got bigger clusters than SIMS could ever get, for example. Because it was softer, you know, the generation of the clusters. We also very well or very courageously left left out a chance that we might have had. One day, one of my students came into my office and said, "I can't get the machine to run. Can you help?" And I went over. And at that time, we had the first transient recorder by Ovation, and it was set in the wrong timescale. And I started to fiddle around with the transient recorder, and all of a sudden, there were these huge signals. And but they were totally in the wrong mass range. But guess what they were?
Like,
rocky balls. We had no clue that that could even happen. You know, I mean, sometimes you come across something and only much later you realize it was some, would have been something interesting. But you know, to be understood that I don't claim anything to having been the first one to see clusters. I had no knowledge about how carbon bonds were formed at that time, and that there were there were magic numbers in the cluster distributions, but that was a different story. So it was just by happenstance that we saw these signals, and we didn't label them. So it's only later on that I think they must have been buckyballs. What else could it have been? Okay, you remember that. For the development of the LAMA, one of the most critical parameters was sensitivity, because you have a very small volume that you desorb or evaporate or ablate, whatever you want to call it, and so there are only a few ions. So sensitivity was a key issue, and the reviewer actually had pointed out that the sensitivity would most probably not be reached. And the idea was there are not enough ions. It turned out that this was not true. Our limitation was not the number of ions of the elements. The limitation was the background signal in the mass spec. There was a grass, you know, on every single mass, or if the resolution wasn't good enough, it was just a shift of baseline. So that limited our sensitivity, because the, let's say, the calcium signal got lost in the background signal that was there. And when we realized that, we began, of course, to think of what is this background? Where does it come from? Now, we saw that there was some regularity in the air, in the intensity of the peaks. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a signal on every mass, but you know, it was small here and then became larger and smaller again. So there was some pattern there that, by just looking at the spectrum, you would immediately pick it up. So that was one thing we knew, and something you must know is that for electron microscopy, you embed your tissue in epoxy resin. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you couldn't cut it on a microtome. So the major material in the sections that we have was epoxy. Mm. So it didn't take us too long to realize maybe these are fragment ions of the organic matrix that our cell is embedded in. And we did a very simple experiment. We just changed the resin from a more tough to a more soft resin. And sure enough, the pattern changed. So that was our first recognition that there could be even molecular organic ions, and that they may be worth pursuing them. This is still in Munich. I mean, when I left for Frankfurt, this I knew, and my decision was to put my major effort in Frankfurt on looking at laser desorption of bioorganic ions. And so we spent about a year looking at every single amino acid. And we found that, yes, you could get molecular signals of the amino acid, but you also got fragments, and the degree of fragmentation depended apparently somewhat on the laser parameters, which we had to or at that time could to some extent change around. We had a Nernst-Jagd laser already by that time, so we could use a tripled and a quadrupled Nernst-Jagd laser. And of course, my background in laser tissue interaction and biooptics, let's say, from that I knew that there were amino acids that absorb in the UVC at about 280 nanometers. Those are the aromatic ones, tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine. And there are, most of the others are aliphatic, and they don't absorb at all. Also, when we went to the tripled YAG laser at 355 nanometer, this we investigated at the quadrupled YAG laser wavelengths at 266 nanometer. And when we went to 355 nanometers, we didn't. There's no absorption of any of the amino acids, and we got much stronger fragmentation and needed quite a bit of higher laser irradiance. And
but so you're looking at the individual amino acids.
We just dissolved amino acids in water. Or water alcohol, or and then just dripped it onto such a grid and let it dry. So preparation was extremely simple.
Then, but you were able, depending upon the wavelength, you were able to get mass spectra.
Mass spectra, but there were, you know, there were apparently differences on the, and the wavelengths was important. Whereas for the llama, it didn't seem to be so important a parameter. But for the amino acid, it was. So, and now comes a little story again. I wrote a proposal and sent it in to the German National Science Foundation. And I was asking for excimer pumped dye laser, excimer pumped and frequency doubled dye laser, that would allow us to continuously change the frequency from 266 all the way into the visible.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? And that was an expensive setup. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't remember how much it was, but it was certainly something like $250,000 or so. Mm-hmm. So I turned it in, and a few months later, I got a reply. Yeah, it sounded kind of interesting, but the risk was pretty high, and the reviewers felt that we should do some more preliminary experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And they just gave us money for one grad student for 1 year. So we did some more preliminary experiments along the same lines. Nothing revolutionary new came out of that. And a year afterwards, I resubmitted the proposal with the results we had gotten in between. And same story, I got the letter back. There was still, the reviewer was not convinced mm-hmm. that this was a useful project to pursue, and we should do more preliminary experiments, salary for a grad student for 1 year. And after the second year, I turned in the proposal a third time and got the same answer. So at that time, I was so angry. I was really mad because I thought, you know, they didn't know what they were talking about. And I first thought to just reject the whole thing and not even take the salary. But then my situation in Frankfurt in terms of funding was very critical. So I couldn't really afford to do that. And after sitting at my desk for an hour and contemplating over the whole thing, I just picked up the phone, called National Science Foundation, and said I wanted to talk to the president.
Mm.
And for a reason that I still don't know, I was put through to the president, you know. And I said I was very angry, you know, this happens a third time, and if the reviewer had good arguments, that would be all right with me. Mm-hmm. But I was never told only his conclusion, mm-hmm. but never his arguments. And I said, you know, this is not fair. And besides that, you are giving out tax money. And if I don't get the reviewer's reasoning, I will sue you. Oh, they say, oh, young man, don't be so. Yeah, but in the end, it wasn't maybe 10 minutes telephone conversation. He said, I'll talk to the officer and ask him to send you the arguments because mm-hmm. I understand you want to go on. And if there are arguments against this project, then you should know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It took about a week. And I got a letter from the officer that was responsible. And it was that long. And it said, reviewer 2 said that the applicants haven't read the literature because it can be read from the literature that the wavelength is not an important parameter in laser resolution. Okay. And that, I must say, the reviewer was at least fair. He gave a reference.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the DFG officer gave me the reference as well. I looked at this, and it was a review paper by David Hercules.
I'm sure you know David Hercules. Yeah.
And we had on the Lama thing, we had closely collaborated with David.
Yeah.
And he also spent a year here as a Humboldt Fellow.
Mm-hmm.
With Benny Humboldt. And I couldn't remember that in that review article there was anything said about the wavelengths.
Yeah.
And so I immediately went to the library, pulled out that review article, and sure enough, there was a statement, and the statement said something like the wavelengths is not an important parameter for these applications. Now, first of all, this was Lama.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, he was quoting a reference again. So this reference was another very well-known review paper at that time, written by Consenius and Zweck. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Yeah.
So they were at Wish National Laboratory, somewhere in the north. Harry Zweck was the senior.
Yeah, it was in Iowa.
Iowa, right. But it was a national laboratory. It was not the not the university.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I knew that review very well, and I couldn't remember having read it in there. Pulled it out, looked at it. There it said, so far, laser wavelength has not turned out to be an important parameter, and gave a reference.
Yeah.
And the reference was one of our first papers we ever wrote on the Lama thing. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to be lucky. So, you know, I wrote up the whole story, sent it to the program officer, and a copy to the president. And within a month, I had my lasers.
Yeah.
So, then we began to systematically investigate the wavelengths as an important parameter, and what we learned from these experiments was that at 266 nanometers, and let me restrict my discussion to the 266 nanometers, the what we then called threshold fluence, that is the minimum laser energy per area that was needed to see clearly identifiable paramolecular ions of the amino acid, of the aromatic amino acids, was about a factor of 12 lower than what was needed for the aliphatic amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes sense, but we had done it in a systematic fashion, and we knew even a number, you know, we knew it was more than an order of magnitude difference that there was.
Interesting.
And because, of course, the aromatic amino acids absorb some at the wavelength 66. It's not right at the center, but it is quite a good.
Much better than the aliphatic.
And in 1983, Michael Karras joined my group as a postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to tell now was already done together with Michael. I will come back to Michael later on. We then went on and looked at dipeptides.
Okay.
And when we analyzed some of the dipeptide spectra, we were very surprised that we got signals of both amino acids reconstituted, and in a peptide bond, you lose one molecule of water, so you can reconstruct the amino acid on the on the carboxy side, but the amino acid, the signal that you get on the amino side of the dipeptide, should be minus water.
Right.
But we saw both there. And
saw the dipeptide as well.
We saw the dipeptide, of course, the dipeptide, and we saw both amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried different combinations of amino acids in the dipeptides and so on. And it was a regular pattern, and since it didn't seem to make any sense, we went two floors down, there was the Department of Biochemistry, and talked to the biochemists and said, you know, this is what we see, and we can't make any sense, what do you think? And he looked at it and said, oh, that's very simple. When you buy dipeptides, it's never pure. There is always some leftovers of the single amino acids, and it's as simple as that. And yeah, that sounded reasonable, and we were at least satisfied that we understood what we were seeing. But we thought we better put that on a more firm basis, and we began to mix amino acids in with the dipeptides and took mixtures only of amino acids, all right? Not dipeptides, but mixtures, and compared. And I saw, you know, can see the day, my office there in front of me, when Michael came in with a spectrum and said, look at this, do you see anything? I said, yeah, it looks okay, what what sample was it? He said, well, this was a sample of a mixture of alanine and tryptophan, mixture. And I said, there can't be. Yes, he said, that's what it is. And so within minutes, we had the concept of matrix desorption.
Mm-hmm.
That at the spectrum was taken at the laser fluence, where we should only have seen the tryptophan mm-hmm. and not the alanine.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the alanine signal almost same strength as the tryptophan, mm-hmm. it was a one-to-one mixture.
Mm-hmm.
So the alanine came riding piggyback on the tryptophan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Molly was really born.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because you saw the effect of having that absorber.
Yeah, well, right. And then we, of course, then we immediately started to fiddle around with the system. We found out that it was advantageous to have the absorbing component, the tryptophan, in much higher concentration than the co-desorbed analyte. And but there were limitations to this. It wasn't really good enough for any analytical method, but the concept of matrix
mm-hmm.
Was certainly there. By the way, one should say it was in the discussion in various aspects at that time. There's a paper by Graham Cooks.
Mm-hmm.
Have you interviewed him?
No.
No, you must. You must absolutely.
Yes, well, tell it to ASMS.
Yeah, Graham is an absolutely great guy.
He's a crazy guy.
yeah, not really crazy.
He wants
very, very inventive.
He wants a mass spectrometer in every garage. Or
yeah, yeah, true, true, true. No, he's driven by mass spectrometry.
Oh, yes,
and mass spectrometry. For sure, but I respect him very much. He had added, sodium chloride or so to some samples for SIM spectra.
Mm-hmm.
And they had also, there was a sentence in that paper saying that a matrix may be important.
Mm-hmm.
And let me try to remember when that came up. I think FAP came later, but of course that's when the glycerol matrix glycerol was called the matrix. It was certainly different in our case, but the matrix we thought was a proper term to be used in that case.
So what time frame was this when Karas came and showed you
that? Karas joined my group in 83,
okay.
And this must have happened in 84. You know, I'm sure it happened in 84,
mm-hmm.
And we published the basic paper in 85 in analytical chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sequence of events. By the way, how late is it?
Yeah, I think we should probably take a break for lunch. Is this a good place to
So discuss? let me quickly finish this and then we'll take a break for lunch.
Okay.
What we did, we were not satisfied with the analytical performance of the system, so we started to look for different matrices, and it was sort of a random search. It would have to be a small organic molecule
mm-hmm.
That was aromatic and had a strong absorption at 266 nanometers, and we pretty quickly, by chance or so, found nicotinic acid.
Okay.
To be a very functional matrix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we got our first really good spectra with nicotinic acid as a matrix.
Okay.
As I said, these results were published in Analytical Chemistry in 85, and already in there we coined the term matrix-assisted laser absorption.
Okay.
It's in a, it's a, as a headline of one of the paragraphs.
Okay. 1985, processes of laser-induced ion formation and mass spectrometry. 1985, influence of wavelength and high radiance.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Okay.
Is it analytical chemistry?
Let's see. Yes, and Alchem. Influence of wavelength and laser absorption of organic solids is amplified for various amino acids and dipeptides. Some absorbing, non-absorbing 266. I'm sorry, 355, the threshold of radiance or attraction.
Yeah.
So that's the 1985 NL Chem paper. Is it followed by Bachmann? Is
he she was an undergraduate student.
Okay, at all.
Well, yeah, well, I think it's only Hilke.
Yeah. So that would be the
yeah, this is the basic paper, which essentially describes all of the features of matrix-assisted dissolution. From there on, it was perfectionating the whole thing.
Yeah.
But the principles were established at that point, I think.
Very good.
So let's have a break now.
Okay. Can we leave everything here?
Yeah. Oh, we can certainly leave everything here.
Push this guy. Stop.